It doesn't mean literally when you will light the light, when you will raise up the light. Because the real translation, the real way of describing the lighting of the candles is, if you have the Targum Unclus next to you, you see that it says, Maleil imaron vesei marlei be'adlokusoch. Hadloko, lehadlik. This should be the way the Torah should describe the action. Lighting neros should be behadlikcho es aneros. So why does it say beha'aloscho? So Rashi says that there is a meaning to this. Because, says Rashi, the second Rashi in the Parsha, al shame. You know why it says beha aloscho, when you raise up the light, and it doesn't say when you light the light. Al shame shehalahav olo. Right? Because the flame goes up like by itself. It says, and Rashi goes on, at shetehe shal heves ole me'eleo. Olo me'eleo. Until the flame goes up by itself. What does it mean? Let's try to understand what Rashi is saying. There are two ways you can light a candle. You can put the original candle which you have, the flame that you have, or the match, and you put it on top of the wick until it actually touches the wick, and then, if somebody is watching you, it seems that you are transferring your flame to the candle. This is one way to do it. But there is another way to do it. You can put your match close enough to the wick, and the wick, all of a sudden, when it's close enough, will seem to come out with its own flame. Really, it's not that way, but that's exactly what it would seem. So, if you are an outside observer, there is a difference for you whether the match touches the wick, or the match is put a little bit distance from the wick, and the wick comes out with its own flame. So when Rashi says, "Ad shetehe shal heves olo me'eleo," what Rashi is pointing out, that it's important that the way Aaron should light the candles is that he shouldn't put the whatever he's holding to light the candles on top of the wick, but allow the perception that the flame is going up by itself. If the Torah tells you that, this is why it says beha aloischo and not behad likho. This is why the lotion, the expression is when you will raise up, because it looks as if it's coming up by itself. We know that there must be a meaning to it. It can't just be a mitzvah. There must be a meaning. There must be a lesson in it. What is the lesson in it? This is what we have to try to understand. Let's go on, another few observations of the mitzvah, and then we'll try to understand the idea behind it. Let's go back now to the beginning of Rashi. The first Rashi. In the Torah, there is a sequence. Even though this is the beginning of the Parshas Baaloscho, it's also the continuation of Parshas Noso, last week's portion of the week. There must be a continuity. What was the theme, what was the subject in the last week's portion of the week at the end? The inauguration of the tabernacle. And how the 12 tribes, everyone sends a representative, the head of the tribe, in order to bring their offering for the inauguration of the tabernacle. So you have 12 presents, 12 offerings as a sign of happiness for the inauguration of the tabernacle. Says Rashi, why is it that the Torah puts it in sequence? The lighting of the candles right after the inauguration of the tabernacle. Lefi shekishero Aaron Chanukas HaNesiim, when Aaron saw that all the heads of all the tribes are bringing offerings, Cholsho Ozdato, he was depressed. Kesheloi Hoyoim Mohem. If you pay attention to who was part of the inauguration of the temple, there were 12 tribes. But in this particular counting of the 12 tribes, the one that's missing, you know, one always has to be missing. Either you count Menashe and Ephraim as one, in order to come out to 12. Either you count Menashe and Ephraim as one, right? and then you count the tribe of Levi, then you have 12. Or you count Menashe and Ephraim, and then you don't count Levi, and then again you have 12. If you take a look in last portion of the week, the ones who were involved in the inauguration of the temple were Menashe and Ephraim. So what's so who was missing? Levi, of course, Levi is missing. And Aaron is the head of the Shevet Levi. After all, he belongs to the Kohanim, who are the priests of the Shevet Levi, and he is the high priest of the Kohanim. So he should represent the Shevet Levi, and he wasn't there. He wasn't part of the inauguration of the tabernacle. So Aaron HaKohen was depressed, right? He was jealous, right? That's what it sounds like on the surface. He was jealous of everybody else that's taking part in the inauguration, and he wasn't. So Omar lo yakodosh baruch hu, so God says, don't feel badly, Aaron. I'll make it up for you. Chayecho. Your action is even greater than theirs. What? Because I will allow you to light the candles in the tabernacle. And lighting the candles is even more than taking part in the inauguration of the tabernacle. This is very, very difficult. We can't see the connection. What does the inauguration of the temple have to do with the mitzvah of lighting candles? There were many mitzvahs that were done. And if you take a look, I quoted here at the end, the last one, as a matter of fact, in number 7, if you have the reference sheet, the Ramban says, Loin is barely, I don't understand Rashi, he says. Lomo nochamu behadlokas neiros. Why did God give consolation to Aaron? You see, Aaron, you are great because you have to bring you have to light the menorah. He did a lot of other things, like lighting the incense every day, the ktoresh, he says, and the lechem, the bread that were changed every week, now on the shulchan. There are so many other mitzvahs. Why is the mitzvah of lighting the candles a substitute for the inauguration? You see what bothered the Ramban is really a double question. Number one, why lighting of the candles more than any other mitzvah that you do in the tabernacle? You bring a daily sacrifice or two daily sacrifices. You burn the incense. You change the bread. You also light the menorah. But that's one of the many mitzvahs that you do anyway. So I don't understand why this mitzvah is more important than all the others. That's the first thing that bothers the Ramban. The other thing that bothers the Ramban is the fact that what does that have to do with inauguration? It has nothing to do with inauguration. Because lighting the menorah was done as the routine of what you did every day. It's nothing to do with an inauguration. How can that be part of the inauguration? Okay, there's something strange. This is what the Ramban says. And that's it. That's what the Ramban asks on Rashi. And the Ramban goes on. And the Ramban says, Bemegillah storim leRabbeinu Nisim, and I found a concealed scroll from the Rabbeinu Nisim Gaon. And Rabbeinu Nisim Gaon says, yes, there is some meaning to it. And the meaning to the statement is the following. Ha-korbonos, sacrifices, kos man shebeis hamikdash kayom heinoy hagin. Korbonos are temporary. As long as we have the temple, we have korbonos, we have sacrifices. Avol haneiros, but candles. Le'oilom el mul pnehan menorah yairu. Candles are forever. Okay? Candles are forever. So the Ramban goes on to say, what do you mean candles are forever? Yes, says the Ramban, candles are forever because we light Hanukkah candles even after the destruction of the temple. Okay? So somehow the Ramban found a connection between the lighting of the candles here and Hanukkah. Right? Let's try to understand a little bit deeper what it's saying here. First of all, the first insight that immediately we get is, now we understand what does the lighting of the candles have to do with an inauguration. Because the lights of Hanukkah, where do they come from? What is the original source of the mitzvah of lighting the lights of Hanukkah? When the Maccabeans, right, when the Hashmonaim came into the temple after their victory over the Greeks, over the Hellenists, what was the first mitzvah they decided to fulfill? The mitzvah of lighting the candles. Okay? As what? As an act of re-inaugurating the temple. That's what it was. Because for a while, for a long time, the temple wasn't used. Okay? And then when they re-inaugurated the temple, This is when they lit the candles. So therefore, there is a connection between inauguration and the lighting of the candles of Hanukkah. As a matter of fact, why do we call Hanukkah Hanukkah? So of course, there are all kinds of hints, Chonuchofei, because it's the 25th. But the real meaning of Hanukkah, you know what it is? The word Hanukkah, Hanukkah Sabayis. Here, what does it mean? Inauguration. Right? Inauguration, that's what Hanukkah means, because the Beis HaMikdash was re-inaugurated at the time. So now we see the connection right away. But there's something more to it than that. take a look at another very, very interesting Rashi. First of all, let's take a look at the Pasuk Gimel. Vayas Kain Aharon, and Aharon did exactly as he was told. You hear the statement? Complimenting Aharon. Aharon did exactly what he was told. And we wonder, why should we assume that Aharon did not follow instructions? Right. What is the chidush? What is the novelty? And if you take a look at Rashi quoting from the Sifrei, you'll be even more surprised. Rashi says, you know how Aharon was great. He was so good. He was such a righteous man. You know what? God told him to light the candles and take a look at Rashi. Vayas kein Aharon lehagid shevochoi shel Aharon, to compliment Aharon. You know what Aharon did? Loi shino, sheloi shino. He did not change from what God told him. Right? Now, if lighting the candles of the menorah would be a very complicated matter, there are 300 little details that you have to fulfill. And if you are lazy, you just won't be able to do them. And Aharon overcame his laziness, and he did exactly what he was told. Okay, we can understand it's a compliment. But we don't understand what is the great compliment. God told him to light the candles, and he lit the candles exactly as he was told. Why should we assume for a second that he did not fulfill? What is the compliment? Shevochoi shel Aharon sheloi shino, right? Aharon did not change anything that he was told. It's something strange, something very difficult. So it's even more difficult to understand. What is the compliment? Why should we assume that he changed when we know, like you said, he suffered from the changing of little details? Why should we assume that he would change? Now, in order to understand what Rashi really means, let's try to understand now the symbolism of the candles. Now that we have the new insight, that we are really talking about Hanukkah. Right? Now, just a short introduction. I mean, we have mentioned this in the past. The concept of remez in the Torah. Now, very often the Torah will tell you something, and at a certain level, we understand what it's saying. But at the same time that the Torah is telling you something at one level, at the same time, the Torah is also telling you something completely different at another level. And if you're attuned to both levels, you really hear both messages at the same time. If you are not, you only hear one. Right? As a matter of fact, we actually use it. We use this method. Even in our prayers, we use this method. Right? I always bring the example. You know, there is a broche, there is a blessing of Kiddush Levona. Kiddush Levona, right? Once a month, you go out and you bless God for giving us the moon. Okay? Fine. We benefit from the moon and we thank God for it. But some of the things that we say there are very, very shocking. One of the things we say is, you know, God, it's enough of the moon shrinking. We have had enough of it. Every month the moon has to shrink and almost disappear and then rise up again. Who needs it, right? And we say, Lemalo is pima salevono. Please, God, it's enough of the shrinking of the moon. Veloye boshumiut. Because we know that originally the moon had its own light, right? According to our tradition, originally the moon had its own light like the sun. And at a certain point, the moon lost the light. And we are so worried about the poor moon, and we ask God, please God, it's enough. The moon has suffered enough. Now, what do we mean? Do we really care about the moon? No, we really care about us, about the Jewish people. Except that when we talk about the moon, at a different level, the moon symbolizes the Jewish people. This is why we have a lunar calendar, because we are very similar to the moon. The same way the moon shrinks and it almost seems to disappear, at that point, all of a sudden it rises up again, and it's alive again, and well again, and full again, and again it comes down again. That symbolizes Jewish history. But so, at a certain point in time, what will happen to Jewish history? It won't come down again anymore, and it will
So what are we doing when we are saying, God, the moon has had enough? We really mean something else. We mean, we have had enough, God, it's enough. So again, we are talking in one level. But at the same time, we're talking in another level, b'derech remes, right? Indirectly, we mean something else. And really, God will understand that other level. And that is a typical method in the Torah. The Torah speaks at different levels at the same time. If you are well attuned, you can understand four levels at the same time, or some say 70 levels at the same time. You just have to be attuned. All right? So this is a typical situation when, once I'll tell you what it means, you will hear the statement. Again, I'll repeat it. Melamed Aaron is great. Mishum shelo shina. He did not change anything. So at the simple level, what does the statement tell you? He fulfilled the mitzvah of lighting candles the way he was told. That is the simple level. But I'm going to tell you another level that on the surface people miss. But in reality, there is another level to that statement. And when you'll hear it, you'll realize there is another level to that statement. So let me give you the background to that other level. Why did the Hashmonaim choose the menorah over all the other mitzvahs? There are so many other mitzvahs. If you want to inaugurate the temple, you can, like you told you before, bring the incense, bring the daily sacrifice, break the bread. Why the oil and the light? Because of the symbolism of the oil and the light. What was the victory of the Hashmonaim in Hanukkah? The victory of the Torah. We have two rabbinical holidays in our Jewish calendar. Two rabbinical holidays. And that is Purim and Hanukkah. And Purim represents the Jewish survival physically. We survived physically because what did Haman want to do? Destroy us physically. We survived. This is why we commemorate our survival through physical means. We eat, we give presents, we drink wine. Okay? As opposed to Hanukkah. By Hanukkah, the Hellenists didn't want to destroy physically the Jewish people. What did they want to destroy? Our Torah, our culture. They wanted the Greek culture to destroy our culture. That's what they wanted. So our victory is the victory of the light over darkness. Therefore, the most proper mitzvah in the Beis Hamikdash to represent this idea is the menorah. So this is the reason why the Hashmonaim chose the menorah. So the menorah is the symbol of Torah. The menorah is the symbol of truth. Kineir mitzvah, the Torah, or is Torah. Why? Because without Torah, without somebody guiding you, without the Torah guiding you, we would be walking in the dark. How would we know what to do, what not to do? How would we know what's right and what's wrong? We need a light. The Torah is our light. This is why, symbolically, the menorah represents the Torah. Okay? So now menorah, the light, represents MS, truth. Right? Truth. Let me tell you something about truth. Truth is something very, very strange. Do you know that everything else which is of importance in Judaism, we say, never does the end justify the means. Never. Right? So therefore, you can't go around stealing in order to give tzedakah, to give charity, like Robin Hood does. Right? Can't do that. Why? Because the end does not justify the means. There is one exception, and that is truth. Truth is flexible. Truth is flexible. For what reasons? When is truth flexible? When against truth, you have another concept against it. When there is a clash between emes and shalom. Shalom. Shalom represents not only peace, harmony among human beings. That concept of harmony among human beings that's called shalom is more important than emes. And at that point, you are allowed to bend the emes for the sake of shalom. Right? Now, it's a statement in the Gemara. The Gemara says, your friend is getting married. Tell him that his wife is beautiful. She may be ugly in your eyes. You tell him she's beautiful. Why? Because shalom overweighs emes. That's what Hillel says. And Shammai argues. And Shammai says, no, when emes and shalom clash, you know what always overweighs what? Emes overweighs shalom. Shalom can't overweigh emes. But what does Hillel say? Shalom overweighs emes. Shalom overweighs emes. What else does it mean? Remember the story? The Gentile a good Gentile who really wanted to convert to Judaism. He just didn't have the patience to study the whole of Judaism. And he comes to Shammai and he tells him, tell me the whole of Judaism in a few seconds. And he, you know, convince me. And Shammai threw him out. Because you can't say the whole of Judaism in 4 seconds. Okay? When he comes to Hillel, what does Hillel tell him? Well, just don't do to others what you don't want others to do to you. The rest is just commentary. Is that the actual description of the whole of the Torah in 1 foot? It requires much, much more. Hillel was bending the emes for the sake of Shalom, because that's his opinion. You bend the emes for the sake of Shalom. Okay? So Hillel's opinion is that when there is a clash between Shalom and emes, what do you bend according to Hillel? Emes bends for the sake of Shalom, and Shammai holds the other way around. Shalom bends for the sake of emes. Okay? Now, let's take it to the next step. You know, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, that basic approach to Emes and Shalom between Hillel and Shammai goes all the way back to Aaron and Moshe. Yeah? Aaron would say, Yikov Hadin Es Hohor, let the truth, let justice move mountains. I don't care if everything has to be rearranged. Truth is truth. Right? That's what Moshe says. I'm sorry. That's what Moshe says. You know what Aaron says? Shore. All have Shalom. The road of Shalom. By him, what was the center of his scale of value? Shalom. So therefore, what about when two people come and one says, you owe me $100. I say, no, I don't owe you anything. What will Moshe say? Let's find out the truth. Right? You know what Aaron would say? Probably. Sure, compromise. Give him $50 and you both be happy. Now, I want you to realize something very important. Sure, compromise is definitely not emes, because either you owe me $100 or you don't owe me $100. There is no way that you only owe me 50. So therefore, by saying 50, what are you gaining? Perhaps the harmony. But you are losing emes. So who was of the opinion that Shalom is more important than emes? Aaron. And it was Moshe who held that emes overweighs Shalom. Okay? Now, isn't it paradoxical that if the menorah represents what? Emes. Who is lighting the menorah? Aaron. There is some paradox in the act of lighting the menorah, right? And who is the one that lights the menorah which represents Emes? Aaron, who represents the power of Shalom over Emes. There is something, not that Aaron didn't believe in Emes, but if Aaron represents this point of view, okay, it's difficult to understand how he is the one lighting the menorah which represents him. There is something incongruous, right? Yeah.
Can I just say, it bothers me the fact that you're saying there's Shalom over Emes, but it's Shalom within an Emes figure.
Of course, there are limits, of course. I don't want to go into too many details. You can't give up everything for the sake of but you see, there are certain limits within which the Torah allows Shalom to overcome Emes, of course. It does not mean, you know, how do people understand? If you go to visit someone, you don't want to hurt their feelings. You can't eat non-kosher food. There are limits to how much you bend the emes. But there are situations, I'm just bringing out the fact that there are situations that within the allowed limits, that emes can be bent vis-a-vis the Shalom, okay? Now, we believe, right, and that's a pasuk in Zechariah, that eventually there won't be a contradiction between Emes and Shalom. Ha-Emes ve-ha-Shalom ehovu means that eventually Emes and Shalom will live together. In our imperfect world of ours, there, we must give, right? Something has to give, either Emes or Shalom. In a perfect world, there won't be any need to that anybody should give to anybody else. You know, there is a statement in the Zohar. At some point in the future, the halacha will be like Shammai. That's what it says. Someday Shammai will. Right now Hillel has to win. But eventually Shammai will win. So everybody's bothered. What does it mean? Eventually Shammai will be right? No. What it really means is that a point in time will come when there won't be a contradiction between truth and harmony. In the perfect world, there is no contradiction. So at that point, what will Hillel say? So do the emes. Of course, there's nothing to bend. That's what it means, that eventually halacha will be like Shammai. So, point is like this. Listen to this statement. This is in Ovois de Rabbi Noson. I quoted it here in the number one, in reference number one. an example of Aaron's wish will to compromise. Kishehoyo Aaron mehalech baderech, etc. V'chein shnei bnei Yodom. He would meet two people. She'osu merivo ze im ze. And they are fighting with each other, and they hate each other, and they, right? Holach Aaron, Aaron goes. V'yoshav eitzel ho'echod, he sits by one of them, which describes spending time. V'yoshav, he sits down, he has all the patience in the world. V'omar lai, beni, re'ei chavercho metaref esliboy. You realize that your friend, the one you are fighting with, his heart is breaking? The koireya is begodov, and he wants to tear his garments. He's terrible. It's terrible his state because you are angry at him. The oimer oily, and he says, oh, how terrible that I made my friend angry. He says, really? That's the way my friend feels? Okay, I'm ready to be friends again. Then you go to the other one. And sell down the same thing, you know, your friend. Terrible how he feels. Are you ready to be friends again? Yes. And this is how he used to bring them together. Sounds childish in the beginning, right? Sounds a little bit childish. Except for one thing. You know that we find, especially in the Hasidic literature, the following concept. The concept is that the reason why we get angry at each other, right, is because we focus at a certain level of our relationship, which is very superficial. We are conscious of that level. But at the same time, there is another level of interrelationship among Jews, specifically among Jews, which is so intense and so close that it would make as much sense to hate your fellow man as for your right hand to hate your left hand. It wouldn't make sense. In other words, can you say your right hand did something wrong by mistake, your right hand hit your left hand, that your left hand will hate the right hand? It wouldn't make sense because there is an awareness of unity. We are all one. What do you mean my left hand will hate my right hand? Unfortunately, we lost that sense of unity, the fact that all Jews are one. We lost that. We don't focus on that. What do we focus on? On the fact that we are different, that we are separate. So therefore, there is room for hatred. What about if someone will reach us a level in which he sees the underlying unity? So when he says, you know, your friend, the one that you're having a fight with, he doesn't want to fight. It breaks his heart. Maybe his friend is not even aware that his heart is broken. But deep inside his heart is broken, except that he, who is not focusing at that level, he doesn't realize that his own heart is breaking because he's only aware of the superficial reaction, which is anger. But Aaron, at his level of understanding of what Jews are all about, he realizes that level. And he had such a power that he was able to convince the other person to look at that level. So we're not talking about childish conversations. We are talking about the depth of human nature, of the nature of the Jew, that Aaron HaKohen had that power without lying. Because on the surface, it would seem that Aaron is lying in order to bring peace into the world. We don't have to come on to that. He wasn't lying. He saw the underlying unity. He saw that the anger is only superficial and deep inside there is no real anger. So according to this, what comes out? Did Aaron himself have to compromise truth for peace? No. At a certain level, you don't even have to compromise truth for peace because you see the truth within the peace, within the harmony. Aaron HaKohen saw the basic unity of the Jewish people that he didn't have to lie. That was no lie when he said, I know that your friend, his heart is broken. At a certain level, his heart is broken. He wasn't even aware of that. So comes out, according to this, that Aaron himself did not have to bend the truth for the sake of peace. Aaron himself was at a level that for him in his life, truth and peace was one. But I just want to point out something which is very interesting. Do you know what is the expression of the rabbis that you are allowed to bend the truth for the sake of peace? I quote it right here in reference number 3. The Gemara Nivomos. Muter, it's permitted, leshanois mipnei hasholom. What's called bending the truth? Leshanois, to change the truth. Leshanois. It's muter. Muter means it's a heter. Do you know the difference between something which is a heter or that's the halachet? Muter means it's a heter. I'm giving you a heter. Muter leshanois, b'di'evet. You know, if the situation calls for it, you're allowed to bend the truth. Ideally, you shouldn't bend the truth, right? But if you have to, bend the truth. Did Aaron have to bend the truth? He didn't have to bend the truth. Therefore, when he lit the menorah that eventually will represent Hanukkah, is there a contradiction between the truth which is represented by the menorah and his lighting? No, because he never lied. He meant it when he said it. Listen now to the words. Says Rashi, Vayas Kein Haroin, you know why Aaron did it? Melamed Shvochoi, Sheloi, what didn't he do? Shino. What was the word used for bending the truth? Shanois. What didn't Aaron do? Shino. He never changed the truth. He was at a level that he didn't have to compromise with the truth in order to make peace. And we find in commentaries, in the Sfasemes and in others, a very interesting insight which fits perfectly with what we are saying. You know that in Sheshes Imei Breshis, in the time of the creation, we have a repetition of Vayomer Elokim, and God said, let there be this and this and this and this, Vayehi Kein. Let there be this and this and this, Vayehi Kein. There is one place where it doesn't say Vayehi Kein, and that is by the light. When God created the light, Yehi Or, it does not say Vayehi Kein. You know what it says? Yehi Or, Vayehi Or, there was light. And the rabbis say, why is it that it doesn't say Vayehi Kein? Because Kein represents exactly the will of God. Kein, exactly the way God wants to. The light wasn't the way God wanted. Why? Because the original light was so potent, was so intense, that the world couldn't take it. So God had to hide that original light. And he only gave us physical light, and this most that we can have. And where is that real light? He left it for tzaddikim, losid lovo, he left it for special people in the future. Right? That's what the Gemara says. So what comes out according to this? That the reason why it does not say chen there is because it was too intense. Now let's understand the intensity of God's creation of light. Are we talking about physical light? Now I want you to realize something. The physical light that we have, it's not only a symbol for truth. It's the physical expression of that higher reality. Everything that we have in the physical world is just an expression of a higher reality which exists in a spiritual world. So there is spiritual light, there is physical light. You know what is spiritual light? Truth. Right? Like as we said before, spiritual light takes the form of absolute truth when everything is clear in your eyes. That is absolute truth. Unfortunately, most people can't reach it. So God left it le'osid lovoy. So comes out, according to this, that the chen that was missing is what? Yehi Or by Yehi Or, there is no chen. Why? Because the truth wasn't given to the masses of people. Who did reach by Yehi Chen? Aaron. Vayas Kein Aharon. He was able to reach the chen that's missing from the days of creation. He was able to reach the level of absolute truth. Okay? Let's go on. Yeah. Yeah. Ke'ish echod b'lev echod. Right. That was that awareness. Right. The thing is, we are always one, but we lose the focus. We don't focus on that oneness. By Matan Torah, they focus on that oneness. Never again. It's absolutely true. Never again. Right. Now let's go on. Now I want you to skip to chapter 11, Yudalet. Right in the beginning, just an overview of what happens, just the chain of events. There is a chain of events here that I want you to pay attention to. First of all, go a little bit back, before chapter 11, three psukim before, Vayisu Mehar Hashem. Lamed Gimel, Posuk Lamed Gimel of chapter Yud. Posuk Lamed Gimel of chapter Yud. Okay? Vayis'u Mehar Hashem. And the Jews traveled away from the mountain of God, from Har Sinai. Listen to the statement of the rabbis. You know what it means? Why does it have to say, and the Jews just went away from Har Sinai, says the oral tradition. Ketinoik, like a child, Haboyreyach mibeis ha-sefer, like a child running away from school. Very important statement. Why? Because we're not defining, we're not saying a child who doesn't like school, because that wouldn't be an adult. We are defining even a child who loves school, and he enjoys school, and he learns in school. But after he goes out of school, there is a feeling of relief. Thank God, school is over. Vacation is starting. That feeling shows that school is good for him, but it's not his natural state. He would still feel more comfortable without school. I mean, he's ready. He recognizes he has to go to school. Everybody has to go to school. But he would rather not. Okay? What about if a child would actually be sad, school is over? Then you know that it's a natural state by him. It's not an artificial state by him. He belongs in school. Okay? So when it says that the Jews, when they left Har Sinai, were in a state of Tinoik Haboy Reyach Mibay Sefer, he's running away, is that last day of school that you say, thank God the school year is over. Thank God. Har Sinai was a wonderful experience. Thank God it's over. Now we can relax. Okay? Now. According to Chazal, according to our tradition, that has an enormous, enormous importance, that feeling, because that shows that there is a gap between Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the one that gave us the Torah from God, right, and the Jewish people. The gap starts to develop. There is a gap. Their closeness between Klal Yisrael and Moshe Rabbeinu is already suffering, okay? Eventually, right? Again? Exactly. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu still belongs to that original level. Klal Yisrael wasn't. Let's go on to the next step. We just will point out certain psukim. The Jews saying in Posuk Vov of chapter Yudalef Vov, 11:6. The Jews saying, Ve'ato nafsheinu yivesho en koil. You know, we want real food. Bilti el hamon einenu. All we see is mon, every day, mon, everything. Right? Right? It's enough of a diet. You know, we had a dietary. Come on, we need real food. Says the Torah, but the Jews weren't saying the truth. You hear? Because in Posuk Zayin, Ve'hamon kizra gadhu, whatever that means. But it means that it was very, very attractive and good and fine. Right? And they did whatever they want with it. And the oral tradition says that they tasted everything they wanted in the man. It was great, the man. So the Jews were making up stories. No. In the Midrash it says that they weren't making up stories at all. But they were saying the exact truth. And that's the problem, you see. The mon tasted according to your spiritual level. In other words, if you were a tzaddik, right? Take a look, I quoted it here in reference number 4, the Gemara in Yuma. If you were a tzaddik, mon was exactly what you wanted. They wanted lechem, for instance, it was lechem, right? For Beinoni, somebody in the middle, and the average person, ugois doesn't mean cakes, but Rashi says it means koide mafio. Ugois means dough. Which means it requires changes, because we can't take it the way it is. We have to change it. Reshoim saw it tochanu boreichaim, as if you gather the wheat and now you have to make it and change it. Who wants to bother with the wheat? That's the way the Reshoim saw it. In other words, that the rabbis tell us that depending on your spiritual level, this is how the man was for you. Okay? So when they said, we can't stand the man, it's terrible, who was talking? The Reshoim, of course. The Tzaddikim would never say it, because for them it was delicious. Okay? Now. Then, there is another story. Listen to the lack of apparent continuity. Moshe Rabbeinu complains to God. Posuk Yudalef of chapter Yudalef. Vayoymer Moshe El Hashem. So Moshe turns to God, he says, if they don't like man, right? They don't like man? Lo mohari oisho labdecho. I've had enough, says Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Posuk Yudbeis. He onoichi horisi eskolomaze? Did I give birth? Was I ever pregnant with these people? Imonoichi ladtio? Did I give birth to these people? Are they my children? Kisoy mare la isroya bechaikecho? I have to worry about them? And then he says in Posuk Gimel, may I leave us, sir? They want meat. How should I have meat? It requires an explanation. Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, did I give birth? What does that have to do with their wanting man? Did I give birth to them? That it's irrelevant. How do I have meat? Who expects you to have meat? It's from you that they want meat. They want meat from God, not from you. Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu complains, I can't take it anymore. If they don't like the man, I can't take it anymore. Why can't he take it? What's so bad about not wanting man? And let's go on with the lack of apparent continuity. In Pasuk Tezayin, God says, you know, Moshe, you can't take it anymore, right? They want man, they want, right? That's what they want. They want Bosor, I mean. They don't want man anymore. They don't want man anymore. Then, Osfoli, you see, Osfoli, Posuk Tezayin, Vayim Rasha Moshe, Osfoli, Shivi Mish Mizikno Yisrael, establish the Sanhedrin, 70 people, Moshe Rabbeinu, you can relax. There'll be 70 people taking care of the Jews from now on. It's not going to be you, it's going to be 70 plus you. And this is the establishment of the Sanhedrin. It's a good question. But in reality, Yisrael did not create the system of the 70 people. Yisrael created the system of the pyramid of leaders. The head of the 10, the head of the 100, and so on and so forth. The Sanhedrin really is being established right now. Now, do you hear any sequence in that? Oh, they don't like man? Okay, let's make a Sanhedrin. What's the connection? Right. Let's go on. Machane. Two people remained in the Machane, in the camp. So Rashi explains, what two people? You see, in order to have 70 representatives of 12 tribes, how many have to come from each tribe? Right? If you have 5, you don't have enough. If you have 6, how many will you get? 72. And how many do you need? 70. Right? But no, you have 12. You know, you really choose 12. Either, you know, one of the two, right? So how many have you got? 70. How many are left from the ones that the tribes chose? 2. So those are the two people. The two people that were not part of the Sanhedrin, but they were the original choice of the Sanhedrin. Okay. So, Vayishuaru shnei anashim ha-machaneh, shem ho echod Eldot, v'shem ha-sheni Meidot. The two people were called one Eldot and one Meidot. V'tonach aleim horuach. Since they were chosen originally for the Sanhedrin, even though they were left behind, the level of spiritual intensity that they reached for being chosen remained with them. So they used it for prophesying. And Yoshua gets so upset that they prophesy. In Posuk Chof Ches. Vayan Yoshua, more in Posuk Chof Zayin before, Vayorot Hanar Vayaged LeMoshe. They told Moshe Rabbeinu, Eldot Umeidot Misnabi, terrible, they are prophesying. And Yoshua says in Posuk Chof Ches, Vayan Yoshua binun meshores Moshe mebachuro vayomar adoini Moshe kloem. Kloem, kloem. Most people say, put him in jail. Kele, bika kele. Put him in jail. Get rid of them. That's terrible what they are saying. What did they say that was so terrible? Says the oral tradition. You won't know what they said. Moshe meis Yehoshua machnis. You hear? They prophesied that this is the end, not now, but eventually Moshe Rabbeinu will not lead the Jews to Eretz Israel. You hear, what is the sequence? Running away from Sinai, right? Running away from Sinai like you run away from school. Next, not wanting the man. Moshe Rabbeinu complaining, did I give birth to them? God saying, okay, appoint us Sanhedrin. And Eldot Umeidot saying, right? No, Moshe is not bringing the Jews into Eretz Israel. And the last story. Miriam says Lashon Hora against Moshe Rabbeinu. He says, what's going on with it? Right? Kisho kushish lokoch, according to the tradition, means why is he separated from his wife? Is that a prerequisite for prophecy? It's not true. We are prophets like he is a prophet. You don't have to separate from the physical life. How come he is so separated? Right? From physical life. Gambonu debarashem. We are also prophets. Here. Yeah? This is Loshin Hora against Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore Miriam receives her punishment, which is, what is the punishment for Loshin Hora? Leprosy. Okay, that's the story. Well, we don't believe she was right, but in any case, what was her justification? Miriam Hanevio, right? We have a different opinion about these people. They were great tzaddikim. What was their mistake? What did Miriam want to do? And what is the sequence? The Jews don't want man? Therefore, Miriam starts saying Lashon Hora about Moshe Rabbeinu. What is the sequence? Let me tell you a little bit of an insight. What really is going on here? Let me tell you a little bit about the nature of the man. The one that speaks about it is the Al-Sheikh. The Al-Sheikh is in his Pirush on the Chumash, says something which gives us an insight into the nature of eating man. You see, usually we eat physical food. Right? We eat physical food. And that physical food gives us life. And we are able to think and to live. That's the capacity of physical food. Right? It allows us to develop a spiritual life. Man was spiritual food. Or spiritual food. It was spiritual food that went through our mouths. But it's not unusual at all. Sometimes we have spiritual food that goes through our ears. Right? Or music can be a spiritual experience. Right? You listen to music and it's a spiritual experience. For the same, another person listens to the same music and will say, this is noise. Somebody else will say, no, this is, don't you feel lifted? Or somebody else will hear something else, and the same person who liked this music will say, that is noise. Right? Which means that your liking or disliking the food that goes through your ears depends on your level, right? How refined you are. The more you refined you are, the more you will like certain types of music, right? The same thing is with the mon. Mon was spiritual food through your mouth. Difficult to conceptualize, but if we can conceptualize it through our ears, so it's not unusual that we say there are certain spiritual foods that go through your mouth, and that's what the man is all about. And you know what the man represented? It was the physical form of Moshe Rabbeinu's teachings. How do we know that? Because the Gemara says, we had the cloud that surrounded us in the Midbar Bizchus in the merit of whom? Aaron HaKohen. We had the water in the Zchus in the merit of whom? Miriam. What did we get in the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu? Man, the manna. Doesn't mean just the merit. It meant that if we are disciples of Moshe Rabbeinu, we would love the man. You hear? The man, our relationship to the man was our relationship to Moshe Rabbeinu. And the saying, we can stand the man. What does it mean in another level? You remember we spoke about two meanings that with the same statement. What are they really saying? Can't stand Moshe. And that was the gap that was developed by Har Sinai is widening. Do you hear that? It's widening. Before it was running away saying, oh good, it's over. Now it became, you know, it's too much. To be so close to Moshe Rabbeinu, he's a great teacher, but after all, you know, we have to keep our distance because otherwise it will overwhelm us. It's too much. It's too much. True? What? Right? Right. That represents something else. But you hear what the man represents. Okay? Now, if that's what the man represents, we can understand exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu says. Listen, they don't like the man, so it's not for me. I mean, the gap is too wide already. So what do you need when the gap is too wide? You have to fill the gap. What was decided? What did God decide? Yes, I will fill the gap between Moshe Rabbeinu, who is all the way up here, to the Jews who are all the way down here. There has to be somebody filling the gap. Who filled the gap? Sanhedrin, this is the 70 people. You hear the reaction? They don't like the man? Okay, let's make a Sanhedrin. What's the connection? This is the connection. They don't like the man means that the gap is too wide. We have to fill the gap. Moshe Rabbeinu can't be their leader. Sometimes the leader is so far from the followers that he can't be a leader anymore. So you need somebody much closer to them to be their leaders. Okay, the Shivim is too bad, Moshe Rabbeinu. Too bad, Klal Israel. You can't be the Talmid in Moshe Rabbeinu anymore. But now let's understand. If you are a parent, you can't divorce your children. You may not like them too much, but you can't divorce them. They are your children whether you like to or not. When you are a teacher, right, and the disciple is not a good disciple, so easy to divorce. He ceases to be your disciple. You cease to be the teacher, and he ceases to be your disciple. In other words, the level of avoiseinu you can't break. The level of Rabbeinu you can break. What is Moshe? Rabbeinu. Who is Avoiseinu? Avraham Yitzchok V'Yaakov. Says Moshe, if I would be Avraham Yitzchok V'Yaakov, I'm stuck with them. But since I'm Moshe Rabbeinu, my relationship to them is teacher and disciple. They don't want me another teacher anymore. You hear this insight? Did I become pregnant with them?
What does it mean?
Is my relationship a relationship that can't be torn apart? It's not like a parent. It's a teacher. So therefore, I'm not their teacher anymore. Get another teacher.
Now we can understand. Shivimish mizikne Yisroel. But let's follow the sequence. Let's follow the sequence. So, what happens if Moshe Rabbeinu can't lead us? Right? Can't lead us because he's too far beyond us. Right? Then Moshe Rabbeinu can bring us into Eretz Yisrael. Because Moshe Rabbeinu can only bring us into Eretz Yisrael if we are his followers, if we are his Talmidei Moshe Rabbeinu. If we cease to be at the level of Talmidei Moshe Rabbeinu can bring us into Eretz Yisrael, which is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. Because like the Gemara says, if Moshe Rabbeinu would have brought the Jews into Eretz Yisrael, the entrance into Eretz Yisrael would have been as miraculous as the exit from Egypt. Did we have to fight our way to get out of Egypt? Did we lift a sword to get out of Egypt? Everything was supernatural because it was Moshe, the supernatural man, who led us out of Egypt. If Moshe would have led us into Eretz Yisrael, then we would have gone in without a fight. And once we would have been there, we would have stayed forever. The temporary nature of our entrance into Eretz Yisrael is because Moshe Rabbeinu didn't bring us into Eretz Yisrael. Because whatever Moshe Rabbeinu does is forever. So therefore, it has to be somebody else. It has to be Yeshua. Okay? So, you hear, when the gap is developed, is it a coincidence that at that point, Eldad Umedad sends the gap, and what do they prophesy? Moshe Mes, the Yeshua Machnis.
Wasn't there a gap beginning with Chesed Eagle right away?
Sure, but it was rectified. Remember, by Yom Kippur it was rectified. Of course, there are signs of that original gap coming back in a different form. Now, what methods can we use in order to close the gap between Moshe Rabbeinu and Klal Yisrael? You try as hard as you can to lift Klal Yisrael to the level that you can again be a disciple of Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? Unfortunately, it was too difficult. To lift Klal Yisrael that they should again be the disciples of Moshe Rabbeinu, the gap can be closed. So, out of desperation, Miriam comes up with another method, which is the alternative method of closing the gap. Bringing Moshe down in order that by bringing him down, the gap can be closed again. And how does it express that final, desperate attempt to close the gap? What does Miriam say? Miriam is not saying just because she dislikes Moshe Rabbeinu, she's jealous of Moshe Rabbeinu. She's doing it as a last resort to close the gap. What does she say? Come on, Moshe. Come down from your high level. Perhaps if you come down from your high level, we can close the gap. So Hashem says it's impossible. The nature of Moshe is to be at the high level. Don't even think of the possibility of his coming down. That is his very nature. If the gap is going to be closed, it has to come from the bottom up and not from the top down. Can we hear the sequence now? It follows exactly the sequence. It's a final desperate attempt to close the gap between Moshe Rabbeinu and Klal Yisrael. By saying what she said, Miriam, she thought she was helping Klal Yisrael. At her level, it's still Lashon Hora, because it said something about Moshe Rabbeinu, which isn't true. Moshe Rabbeinu isn't what he is out of a choice. He could be something else. He chose to be higher, right? He chose to close himself up in his private room and study. No, that's not the point. That is his very nature. You can't bring him down. But at least we understand what was the justification of Miriam. So, of course, at her level, she shouldn't have said it. She made a mistake. But at least we can justify her mistakes.
In any case, the punishment for Moshe the Pshoram is the 70 or the people. And Moshe himself was punished.
Of course, I mean, the fact is that Moshe Rabbeinu lost out something, right? But it wasn't his fault. Okay, we'll stop here.